In cold case investigations to both the scriptures and to the idea about the existence of God. Is there any really good reason to believe? Look, you're in this room. Are you here because this feels good? Are you here because this is working for you? Or this is because, are you here because you were raised here? A lot of you were raised in this church, I know. Is that why you come to church? Is this part of your life, part of your routine? That's not why I go to church. I've got family who would say they go to church that way. They know their experience, and that's all they've ever done is go to church. My question is, okay, that's fine, that's great, but is it true? I mean, is it true in a way that we could demonstrate evidentially? My kids wanted to know that too, by the way. And although a lot of us, you know, my age, we're like, I don't really even care that much to know what the case for Christianity is. I'm already in. I already believe this is true. You got kids sitting next to you? They may be in the same position you're in. Most likely they're not. Most likely they've got deep questions they want answered. And they may stay with you quietly for a season, but at some point they are going or to check out. And by the way, when we poll people in college who have left the church and we ask them, when did you first step away? It's almost always between the ages of 12 and 17. Really? They aren't even in college yet. That's right. It turns out they left before they left us. We have a duty, I think, to be able to answer some of these questions. I want to answer them for my kids. I now have a son who is doing the same job that I was doing for years before him. He has the same name I have. We only use one name over and over and over again. So we're like the George Foreman of law enforcement, okay? Do you guys know who George Foreman is? He's a boxer. He had six boys and he named them all. What name are they? George Foreman. So he has my name. He's using the same tools I used before him, at the same uniform, driving the same kinds of cars. I did the same thing that my dad did before me. He has the same name I have. We have been doing this job with that name on our nameplate for 57 years. So what I want to share with you tonight is an approach that I hope you'll be able to adopt and then start to rethink the way you've been thinking about your faith. I was asked a couple of years ago to do a very short scene in a movie called God's Not Dead 2. Now, I wasn't sure what to expect here, but I knew I was going to have about 6 minutes to make a case for what I believed, for what I knew to be true evidentially. Now, think about that for a second. If someone said to you, okay, I'm going to give you 6 minutes to explain why you think God exists, how many of you think right now you'd be ready to give a quick 6-minute presentation? If so, I want you to come up right now. We'll do it right now. No? It turns out you have to know a lot more than 6 minutes worth of information to go back and get the 6 minutes you want to use. So tonight, I'm going to teach you a process we use at death scenes that I think will help you make the case for God's existence. So in other words, we're going to jump right in to what I call Death Investigations 101. I've been teaching this to investigators as well, but tonight we're going to apply it to the examination of God's existence, okay? You know, it turns out that not every death scene is a crime scene. Did you know that? There are 4 ways to die. Only one of them is criminal. I hope when I get called out in the middle of the night, it's one of the other 3. You know why? Because I'm going home. But if it's a murder, I have to stay. Let me give you an example. Let's start with a dead guy. A dead guy laying in the room. Now, he looks suspiciously like my son, Jimmy, but pay no attention to that. Now, is that a crime? Maybe. What do we have evidentially? So far, we have a dead guy laying face down. That's it. Well, how do we know if that's a crime? Well, we have a process. I'm going to teach it to you. You ready? We make 2 lists. 2 lists that begin with an E. The first E list is a list of evidence in the room. So we'll make that list on one side, okay? And the second list is a list of explanations. Both these lists start with an E. Okay, so far all we have is a dead guy laying face down in the room. Now, how do we explain dead guys that are laying face down in the room? Well, there are 4 ways to explain dead guys. Maybe you can volunteer this. We'll have a little participation here. What are the ways people die? Heart attack. Okay, so that would be like a natural death. Well, yes. Boy, someone's been watching criminal shows. Blunt force trauma. A ligature death. Yes, yes, there's another way you could, if they accidentally fell down or something, that's, and there's a suicide, someone said suicide, we can put that on the, now these are three ways you die that I don't even care about, okay, because the fourth one is what I care about, and that is the blunt force trauma, which is the homicide. Got it? These are the four ways that people die. Now the only question left is, how do we know which of these four ways this guy died? Well, we start to look at the evidence on one side, and we compare that evidence to the ways you could explain it, and we say, which of those explanations is the most reasonable in light of the evidence? Now here, I think we can start to cross some things out. So which of these four explanations, given what we know so far, do you think it's safe to cross out? Well, okay, look, if he had a heart attack, a natural death, he would look just like that. If he accidentally took too many pills, he would look like that. If he intentionally took too many pills, he would look like that. If I poisoned him with too many pills, he would look like that. Do you see that right now? Every one of these explanations is not equally, only equally possible. It's equally reasonable. Can't cross out anything. Let's change the scenario, though. What if he's a dead guy laying face down in the room, but now he's in a pool of his own blood? Would that change things? Let's add that to our list. We've got a pool of blood. We'll put that on that list. That's the list of evidences over on that side. Okay, now what can I cross out? Yeah, well, what if he had a brain aneurysm, hits the deck, and he bleeds out through his nose? Happens all the time. If that happened, there would be blood around his head. Because that's where. Now, I've got blood coming out of center torso. How in the world can someone bleed? What, out of what place are they bleeding naturally at center torso? Do you see the problem here? I think it's reasonable for us to now cross out. Now, we could easily say, isn't it still possible that it's a natural? Yeah, anything's possible. We're not after possible. We're after reasonable. So we're going to cross out the one that we think is the least. Can I cross out anything else? Can I cross out suicide or not really? I got to roll him over and see what the injury is, right? So let's change the scenario. What if he is a dead guy laying face down in a pool of blood, but now he's got a single gunshot wound in his torso, and that is an exit wound coming out of his back? It changes things. Let's go ahead and put that on our list. Now, what can I cross out? Well, okay, he just doesn't know the gun is loaded. He's handling a loaded gun. He doesn't know it's loaded. He accidentally shoots himself. That's the exit wound. That's still in the, I think that's still in the range. That's got to stay up there. Suicide really has to stay up. Everything has to stay up there still. I've added additional evidence, but still I cannot eliminate possible explanations. Let's change it. What if in addition to all of that, we also have on the floor next to the body a suicide note? Yeah, and when we examine the note, it's on a piece of paper that we find elsewhere in the room. It's in his own handwriting. It's only got his skin cell transfer DNA. It's only got his fingerprints on it. Now I'm going to add that piece of evidence to my list. Okay, let's put it on our list. Tell me, what can I cross out? I think I can cross. Now, he may have accidentally killed himself before he intended to kill himself, but it looks like I can cross out accidentally, right? Are you sure now what this is? What do you think it is? You're shaking your head. You don't think it's a suicide, do you, sir? Maybe. Well, okay. How many of you think this is not a suicide? There's a suicide note on the floor. Oh, so it's in his handwriting. So, okay, so you're telling me that somebody forced him to write his own suicide note because you have been watching Criminal Minds. Right? So you think you know how this works? No. Okay, Criminal Minds is stupid, okay? So stop watching that. I have a whole talk on TV stupid, okay? That's not stupid. All right, let's change this scenario slightly. Let's change it slightly. Let's say, okay, we're back to our scenario. Let's say that we have, in addition to, let's say we examine the suicide note, and it's not on a piece of paper that we can find anywhere else in the room. It's not in his handwriting. It's a stranger's handwriting. A stranger's DNA is on the note. Ooh, that would change things. How about this? What if he didn't have one gunshot wound? He had multiple gunshot wounds. What if those wounds were all entry wounds on his back? Oh, yeah. What if there was bloody footprints leading out of the room? Would that change your mind? Let's go ahead and add those things to our list here. There you go. You can see this is a California murder right here. That's the beach out there. This is the surfing murderer. Okay, so we're going to add these features. Now we have multiple entry wounds on his back. We have foreign fingerprints. We have bloody footprints leading out of the room. And now when I add this to the list, I think we can begin to see, okay, look, now I think we can start to cross out suicide, right? It's kind of hard to shoot yourself multiple times in the back and then walk out of the room in your own blood, okay? So that now we can cross out. This now leaves us with one most reasonable inference from the evidence. This process is called abductive reasoning. Abductive reasoning. It's also called inferring to the most reasonable explanation. Jurors do this all the time. You do this all the time. When your kids come home and they're late and they give you some lame excuse, you start to wonder. I had a partner one time, he used to always tell me that he was a salty old guy who was always a pain in the rear, and he was no fun to work with sometimes, right? Because he's always grumpy. And one night he confesses to me that he would stay up late and wait for his son to come home so he can give him a hug and a kiss before he went to bed. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. I know you. I can't even imagine you hugging and kissing your own kids, right? He says, don't be stupid. I just want to get close enough to him so I can smell if he's been smoking dope or start drinking. What's he doing? Abductive reasoning. He's collecting his little bits and pieces. Now, we did something else here that I think is helpful when we're talking about the existence of God. And I want you to see it. The other thing we're doing when we work these kinds of death scenes is we're playing a little game I call inside or outside the room. Here's what I mean. If I can explain everything that's in the room by staying in the room, it's not a murder. Did you hear what I said? If I can explain everything that's in the room by staying in the room, it's probably not a murder. Now, I'll show you what I mean by that. Let's just take the room here, and we'll make it a little graphically simpler. Let's say the room is like a box, and he's in the box. Here he is. Now, the question is, we're going to play this little game of inside or outside the room. If I can explain everything that's in the room by staying in the room, it's not going to be. Here's what I mean by that. So let's say, for example, I got this note. Well, it's in his handwriting. It's on paper I find elsewhere in the room. He can do that by himself in the room without any help from anyone else. I can now explain the note by staying inside the room. Follow me so far? Also, let's say I talk to somebody and they say, oh, yeah, he's owned that gun for years. He loves that gun, and it sure is, it's registered to him, and they tell me that he keeps it in a safe that's in the room. Now I can even explain the gun in the room without anyone else's help. I can stay in the room for an explanation. And anyone can shoot themselves. Oh, I love it when we have people who are signing, because if you talk really fast, I can't keep up with you. And you can talk a lot of big words like ligature and other things like that. What is the sign for ligature, by the way? You have no idea, okay? That is very impressive. That is very impressive. I got to get my speed up a little higher. Okay. So, but here, one single gunshot wound, anyone can shoot themselves once without any help from anyone else outside the room. Agreed? These now are features of the crime scene that I can explain by staying inside the room. Now, if that's the case, it's going to be one of these three. It's obviously not going to be a natural. It's going to be an accidental or a suicide. On the other hand, if I have to go outside the room for the best explanation, everything's going to shift. If, for example, I find out that there's foreign fingerprints on that note, it's not on paper that's native to the room, it's not with a pen, it's going to be foreign DNA, foreign fingerprints, foreign handwriting, I now have to go outside the room to figure out who wrote that note. And if someone tells me, oh yeah, he's afraid of guns, he would never own a gun, and sure enough, it's not registered to him, and there's no skin cell transfer, and there's nothing else biological that ties him to the gun, now I got to go look for whose gun that is. And it's kind of hard to shoot yourself several times in the back without any help from anyone else, right? And finally, I have bloody footprints leading out of the room. Clearly, I'm needing to find a cause for this crime that's outside the room. Now, everything shifts to homicide. Why? Because I now have evidence of an intruder. It's pretty simple. Intruders change everything. Intruders, in fact, are the very thing that turn death scenes into crime scenes. I'm looking for evidence of an intruder. Simple. Also, you might have some sense of curiosity about why someone would kill themselves or why they, how they could die accidentally, but once you know that you've got an intruder, your sense of curiosity better shift to a sense of urgency, because the one show on TV that gets it is a show called The First 48. Have you ever seen it? Pretty boring show, really. It's just a guy with a camera following around cops in the first 48 hours. Now, look, the first 48 hours is the chance you have to get there before everyone's stories get lined up, before all the evidence gets destroyed. When you wait 30 years, it's a lot harder to solve cases. So we want to work quick. All that being said, when I was a brand new investigator of Christianity, at some point I said to myself, I got a problem with the supernatural miracle stuff that's in the scriptures. I need to know, is there anything supernatural, really? I believe there wasn't. And I was going to look at the universe this way, like a room. Can I explain everything that's in the room by staying in the room? Or is the best explanation outside the room? In other words, there are things in this room of the natural universe, just space-time matter governed by physics and chemistry. There are things in this room that I have to explain. Can I explain all of them by staying inside the room using nothing more than space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry? If I can explain everything that's in the room by staying in the room, there's no intruder. On the other hand, if I can't, and I have to go outside the natural realm of the universe to get an answer for what's inside the natural realm, well, then I got a problem. And I think there are eight things in the room that everyone has to explain, regardless of who you are, regardless of what you believe. First, we are in a room that has a beginning. That's right. All space, time, and matter came into existence from nothing. Oh, you mean like, like space is nothing, right? I mean, it's like a big void. There's nothing there. It's just space. No. Space is not nothing. Space is something. What? Yep. Yeah. Yeah, we're saying, and by the way, this is not just the claim of Scripture in Genesis 1. This is the claim of science in the standard cosmological argument called Big Bang cosmology. All space, time, and matter, according to the science, came into existence at one point in the past from nothing. Well, what is nothing if space is something? I thought space was nothing. You're telling me space is something? Yes. Well, it's nothing. It's what Aristotle says nothing is. It's the stuff that rocks dream about. Nothing. Got it? Now, you have to change definitions here in order to change this. But the reality of it is, we got to explain how something could cause everything to come into existence. And whatever this is that causes all space, time, and matter to come into existence, it cannot be spatial, temporal, or material, because those things aren't available to you. Follow me? We're already kind of in a problem situation, don't you think? Not only that, the universe we see is incredibly fine-tuned. All the cosmological constants are incredibly fine-tuned to a razor's edge. The smallest deviation in weak force, the strong nuclear force, electromagnetism, gravity, all of these things are just small variations, and we don't even get a universe that comes into existence and stays in existence. And certainly we do not get a universe that will support life. The fine-tuning of the universe is remarkable. And by the way, it's not even controversial. Even atheist astrophysicists will admit we've got to explain the fine-tuning of the universe. Not only that, we have life that comes into existence from non-life in this universe. How does that happen? How does inorganic matter turn into living biological organisms? And not only that, when we study those organisms, they show the appearance of design. They appear to be designed. Worse yet, Craig started off the talk tonight talking about, you're thinking about this right now. What are you using to think about it? Using your brain? Do you have a mind? Really? Well, atheists believe in brains. That's stuff that's made up with space, time, matter, acted upon by physics and chemistry. But minds are immaterial. They reject minds. Sam Harris, the neuroscientist who's also a philosopher, has written two books on this issue. He rejects the idea that we have minds. He says you have a brain, but not a mind. That's an illusion caused by your brain. So we got to explain consciousness, mind. Worse than this, if we don't have minds that are free to think freely and we are just brains affected by prior neurons that are firing like dominoes falling against dominoes, that means that your thoughts are not free. Your thoughts are simply the consequence of prior activity in your physical brain, like dominoes. Dominoes are not free to fall. They only fall if fallen against. That means that Sam Harris says you don't have the kind of freedom you think you have because you can't control the prior neuron firing. So he denies free agency also. But we seem to experience mind. We seem to experience free agency. How do we get it with just space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry inside the room? Is there a better explanation outside the room? Finally, we know that we have objective moral truths. Do we get those by staying inside the room? Are those just inventions that we invent as communities or as persons? Or are there objective standards that existed before we even knew what they were? If so, where do they come from? And finally, what is that standard of goodness, of righteousness that we think is the standard by which anything is called evil? I'm not going to go through all this with you tonight, but I want you to see that there are eight things in the room you have to account for. The only question is, can I explain these things by staying inside the room? Or is the better explanation outside the room? And if it is outside the room, then you and I both know we've got another problem. We've got an intruder problem. Only this intruder spans the entire cosmos. Now, this is why I wrote a book called God's Crime Scene, not because I was suggesting that God had committed a crime, and my publisher was telling me we can't use this title. People are going to be confused. I said, no, trust me, they won't be confused. We'll figure it out. I'm saying you could actually investigate the universe like a crime scene. Make sense? And that's what we're going to do. Now, I will tell you this. I actually teach this class at Biola. It takes 17 hours to go through all eight pieces of evidence. Now, I'm not going to put you through 17 hours. So if you needed evidence that there is a God, you just got it. Because I'm not going to force you to sit here for 17 hours. Yes, therefore, there is a God. We can go home. Okay, you're ready to go. But what we're going to do is return to our crime scene and say, okay, look, this is how we handle crime scenes. We make a list of evidences, a list of explanations. This is how we're going to handle the universe. We'll make a list of evidences. In this case, there's eight. And then we'll make a list of explanations. And in this case, there are two. We can either stay inside the room, and if that's the case, these are unguided natural laws that create everything. Physics and chemistry acting on space, time, and matter. Or we go outside the room for a supernatural, extranatural being that is the cause of these eight things. And tonight, to spare you all eight explanations, we're just going to talk about one. This one, that life somehow emerges in the universe from non-life. How in the world does that happen? How do we go from dirt to living biology? How do we go from just the basic building blocks of life to the fine-tuned, designed organisms that we are? How does that happen? Now, I had a case a number of years ago, and it occurred about 4 days before New Year's Eve. And so I knew as soon as we got the call out, this was going to be terrible because I knew we'd be working this case through the holiday, and I was upset. We get there, and sure enough, the guy is at his workplace. He works at a warehouse. He's been shot in the head. Next to his body is a cell phone. A smartphone that has a text. And I first looked at this text and I thought, man, what is this? Is this like a... Here it is. I thought, I'm not sure I've ever seen a text like that. Is it related to the crime? Is it an accident? The sequence doesn't seem to make any sense to me. Is it a butt dial? Is it an encoded message to the deceased, to the victim? Long story short, it was an encoded message from his wife, Rachel, who wanted to have her husband killed because she had started dating another guy, and this affair had been going on for about a year, and she told her boyfriend that she wanted her husband dead before the end of the year, and now it's 4 days before the end of the year. He's a procrastinator, and he has to get the job done now. So she says, today is the day you're going to do it. He says, okay. He goes over and starts heading over to the husband's place of business. And while he's en route, her husband calls and says, I'm coming home early. It's the holidays. It's dead here. I'm just going to close shop. We're going to come home. That's not good because she has the killer heading over to the business. So she texted him this message. And as I did all phone tolls for all of her phone messages, I wrote warrants for all that stuff, I could see that she had done this many times in the past, only the numbers would be different. This is a message to her husband that says, I will be there in 30 minutes. Sometimes I'll be there in 15 minutes. I'll be there in 10 minutes. He knew what this meant. So rather than just leave, he waited for her to arrive. And that gave the killer time to get there. So it turns out this message is not a butt dial. It's not an accident. The phone didn't do it by some kind of physical property of the phone. Instead, it was an encoded message that she sent, and he understood it because they had this common language, and it froze him in place long enough to die. Make sense? It turns out this is very much the explanation for how life originates in the universe, because you probably are all familiar with this molecule, the biggest molecule known to humans. This is DNA. And in DNA, there are four nucleotides that are arranged in a particular sequence. And I wish it was only this short. It goes off in that direction forever. Oh, it seems like forever. Off in this direction 4 miles. And it has more information density than I can possibly explain to you. A small piece is said to have the same kind of density as every bit of data and information on the Facebook platform. Every comment you've ever seen, anyone's ever made. This is an incredibly dense molecule. And these nucleotides are in a specific, this is not random, this is information. This is actually directions for life. Everything about you somehow is represented in this DNA. Why does your nose look that way? Why are your ears like that? Why do you either have attached lobes or detached lobes? All of these things are dictated by the information in your DNA. And therein lies the problem. Is that truly information? If it is information, how did it get there? What is the set of physical properties in this physics and chemistry that would cause these nucleotides to come together in exactly that sequence? Is it really a property of physics or accident? That's the only way to explain it inside the room. Or is there some mind behind this information? And that's where a gentleman named Stephen C. Meyer comes in, right? An incredibly brilliant man who wrote a book called Signature in the Cell. And what he talks about in Signature in the Cell, I'll give you the money line. It's a really thick book. You may want to read it, but here's the money line. He says, there isn't a single example anywhere in the history of science or the history of the universe, for that matter, in which we have any example of information coming from anything other than intelligence. If you think you could have got some example out there of information coming from something other than intelligence, please tell me. There is none. Our practical experience tells us that information always comes from intelligence. If not, give me another example of this. Oh, I don't know, Jim. I don't know. I don't think so. I think we see it there. And if you deny that there's an intelligent mind that is writing the code in the DNA, where else could it come from? Well, it's got to come from some physical property. Here's what I see people doing. I see people saying, hey, number one, this isn't really information. It's an illusion. It might be like information, but it's not really information. Or they'll say, no, physics can make that. That's one of the only options they have to stay inside the room. Let me show you why that doesn't work. If you really want to go to sleep fast tonight, I suggest you get a book by Werner Gitt on information, okay? Sorry, Werner, but it's really hard to read this book. It's a hard book, so I'm going to try to recast the information because it turns out he's brilliant, and he talks about 5 levels of information. The only question is what level is DNA? So I'm going to give it to you in a way that I think is easier to understand. Tell me right now, if you're in this room and you have a pet, raise your hand. Everyone's got a pet. Some of you are married to your pet, okay? No. Okay, how many of you have a dog? Raise your hand if you have a dog. Okay, all of your dogs are mutts compared to my dog. I'm just going to tell you right now. Seriously. What do you think is it? If you're really proud of your dog, just raise your hand. Okay, fine. What's your dog? A pit bull. There's a reason why the word pit isn't the word pit bull. Go. What's your dog? Yes, right there. Yes, right there. A what? A border collie. Yeah, it's not bad. It's not bad. How many have border collies? The border collies. Like one more chance. The best dog in the room. If you have the best breed there is, raise your hand. Go.
Labrador. What?
Labrador. Those are the dumbest dogs, I swear. Are they not the dumbest dogs? They are dumb as a rock, I swear to you. They will chew things. They'll chew everything. If you aren't smart enough to know food from shoes, you're a Labrador, okay? We've got guys I work with. We would say, he's a nice guy, but he's a Labrador. I will show you the dog you all should own, okay? How many of you have watched Netflix this year? Confess to it. Raise your hand. Have you watched The Crown? Yeah, well, there's four of these on The Crown. Why? Because this is the best dog ever bred by humans. Welsh Pembroke Corgis. I'm serious. That is the best dog ever. Now, I will show you how smart this dog is. If I put a typewriter in front of my dog, Bailey, and I tell her to type something, she is so smart that she could type something. You want to see her first effort? I will write on the chalkboard what Bailey types, okay? Her first effort, here it is. Wow, that's good, right? Now, you look at that and you think to yourself, that is junk, okay? That's like just any random thing that she's banging out with those little, I mean, corgis don't even have elbows, okay? All they have is just the first part of the leg, okay? They don't. And there is this thing typed out, okay? Now, is that information? Actually, it is. It's a very low level of information. It's complex, but it's not specific in that you don't recognize anything there specifically. But it's complex. What are the odds that Bailey would type that same exact sequence a second time? It's pretty complex. Probably not very good odds. But is that what DNA is? No. What if Bailey could type a pattern? She could do a TT spacebar, TT spacebar, and she produces this repeating pattern. Is that information? Yeah, it is actually. It's a little more specific, but it has no meaning yet. I could ask the question, what is Bailey telling us up here? I don't know. What's Bailey telling us here? I don't know. Now, it turns out that if I stay inside the room, I can get both of these. This is accidental. You can get that inside the room of the natural universe, just random chance. Or this is, I can get with some kind of physical attraction process. Snowflakes, for example, or crystalline structures have amazing repeating mathematical patterns are caused by physics. Even if she could type a more distinct pattern, like T13T, spacebar. I mean, if she did that, that would be much more complex. And by the way, if you saw Bailey type this line or this line, you'd go, wow, that's a smart dog. You would. Is that what DNA is? No. But you could get this by staying in the room. You can get these kinds of patterns from random chance and from base physics. You can get these kinds of patterns. This is the lowest level of information. It's called statistics. Not the kind you're thinking of. This is just the name they use for this. Now, is this DNA? No, it's not DNA. DNA is far more sophisticated than this. What if Bailey could type this? Wow. Now she's typing letters in specific sequences that we recognize as words. Granted, I don't know what she's saying here yet, but this is a step up. Would you agree? This is not what DNA is either. It's closer. By the way, you can get this inside the room. You can't get this inside the room because we recognize a code that she is coding and we are decoding. This requires a step outside the box for intelligence. We're already now one level outside the room. And this is not DNA either. This is another level up. This is called cosyntics. What if Bailey could type this? Now she's got words in the right sequence. Here's a sentence I actually understand. Right? She's telling me something. Grandpa's eating. We are now two levels outside the room, yet we are not yet at DNA. This is the next level up in information. Information that has specific wording and specific semantically correct is called semantics. By the way, you know people. I know people who are learning a language for the first time. And they will, sometimes they're like stuck. They get the right words, they put them in the wrong order, right? They sound kind of silly because they're just learning the language for the first time. I was in a restaurant, a Thai food restaurant in Malibu, California. I walked in the washroom and I saw this sign. I had to take a picture. Here it is. Please do not throw paper wiping hand down toilet. Now, I'm guessing they don't mean the hand you use to wipe, don't throw it down. No, they don't mean that. They mean don't throw your paper towels down the toilet. Now, you can see they're close. They're kind of stuck between cosyntics and semantics. They're like a 2.7, okay? All right, let's go back to our list here. What if Bailey could actually do more than just describe something? She could make a request. That's a whole other level of information. Not just describing something, but to make a request requires another level of knowledge. So here's her request. Let's feed me. Let's eat. That is a level of information called pragmatics. Very practical, right? Now, we are now 1, 2, 3 levels outside the room. You can't get this with just random chance, space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry. Yet, this is still not what DNA is. And if Bailey expects Grandpa to get up off his rear and actually feed her, in other words, she's making a request because she thinks it's going to happen, because what she really wants is a walk, and the walk always comes after we get fed. Okay, she's trying to get to the walk. She's so smart, she's asking this request knowing it'll get met so we can get to the walk. That's a whole nother level of information, and that is called apobetics. Well, where is DNA? It's over here. 4 levels outside the room. Now, how do we know that? Well, we can do a couple things. We can say, look, if I compare the lowest level of information to the highest level of information, I could ask the simple question, what is she saying? Up here, I have no idea. I can't figure that out. And down here, I know exactly what she's saying. Also, you'll notice that the more sophisticated the level of information, the more important small changes are. I can make a change to this top line. I can take out almost all of it. It won't make any difference to meaning. The meaning is going to be the same no matter what I take out because it's a low level of information. I think you know where I'm headed with this, right? This is why commas save lives, okay? Because in high levels of information, if I take out the same amount of data, I have a huge change in meaning. Why? Because it's a high level of information. So here, if I take out the same comma, sweet Bailey who wants to get fed by Grandpa is suddenly turned into killer Bailey who wants to eat Grandpa. Do you see the difference? Okay. Now let's go and turn over to Billy the Kid or Jesse James. I forget who this is. He's got a DNA strand that actually describes who he is, that accounts for his features. And we know this is a high level of information because what's happening here is the DNA is making requests that shape proteins from amino acids in the body. And these requests are being made because there's a goal in mind to create a micro machine down the road that'll do something else. And I'm making this request over here to get the amino acids in the right protein shape, these proteins together in the right shape to go together to make the machine. I'm making this request with an expectation that's met way over here. This is level 5 information, and we know it's high level of information because, for example, let's just take out one of these nucleotides and we'll change it. Now, there is some self-correction. This is how amazing your DNA has been designed. It does have some self-correction capacity, but not too much. That's why genetic therapies that treat diseases by changing the code are effective, because small changes in this DNA result in big changes in you. If we were to change that, something about Billy is going to change. His forehead, his nose, his ear, something's going to change because this is a high level of information. It's not 1, 2, 3, or 4. This is 5. This is actually, some of your DNA is level 4, some of it is level 5. And the point I have here is that you can't get this by staying in the room, and they know it. So Paul Davies at Arizona State University puts it this way. Hey, we're still left with the mystery of where biological information comes from. Now, he's an agnostic. He's not a believer. If the normal laws of physics can't inject information, and he knows they can't, and if we're ruling out miracles, and he wants to because he's not a believer, then how can life be predetermined and inevitable rather than a freak accident? How is it possible to generate random complexity and specificity together in a law-like manner? We always come back to that basic paradox. As a matter of fact, this was persuasive for me. But I'm not the only person that was persuaded by this. There's a very famous atheist named Anthony Flew, who used to go to C.S. Lewis's chambers and have a cigar. And he was probably the most influential atheist of the 20th century, very well respected as an atheist. He wrote a lot of books. He debated. As a matter of fact, he wrote this book, The Presumption of Atheism, Other Essays. Remember when Lee came out and said he did a debate at his home church with William Lane Craig? Well, he's also debated William Lane Craig as an atheist, debating the Christian. He's a professor at distinguished universities. He had all the pedigree you'd be looking for. and a good, devout atheist professor. All of that, though, but at some point, he changed his mind. And he wrote a different book, a book called There Is a God. And when he wrote that book, he talked about how he finally came to this conclusion. Here's what he said. I now believe that there is a God. He says, I now think that the evidence does point to a creative intelligence almost entirely because of the DNA investigations. You hear that? Just because of the DNA. He started to lose his confidence that you could do this inside the room. What I think the DNA material has done is that it is shown by the almost unbelievable complexity of the arrangements which are needed to produce life, that intelligence must have been involved in getting these extraordinarily diverse elements to work together. No kidding. Now, if we wanted to stay inside the room, there's only two ways to do it when it comes to DNA. Well, it could be just random chance. It could. Now, by the way, you have some illustrations here. My background before I became a police officer, I spent the first part of my life as a designer and as an architect. I went to UCLA and studied. I got my master's there in architecture. That's what it felt like. And then I left that to become a police officer. It's funny how families will kind of draw you back to your family work, right? This is our family work, so here I am again. But this is a problem. If you're going to suggest that it's physics or chance, well, the chance won't work. It won't work because you cannot get this level of complexity by chance. There's not enough time in the history of the universe to get the simplest complexity by chance. But worse than that, we haven't even talked about chicken and egg problems in biology. Let me explain this to you. You know that amino acids are formed together into proteins. What dictates that? The information in your DNA. Here's the problem that they have to deal with. It turns out that amino acids are shaped into proteins in a machine in your body, a little micro machine called a ribosome. Ribosomes are what turn amino acids into proteins. No proteins, no building blocks, you got to have proteins. Now, it turns out the ribosome machine is made out of what? Proteins. So you have a machine you need to make proteins that's made out of proteins. Do you see the problem? It's a chicken and egg problem, and there are tons of these in biology. The only way to circumvent these is with information that puts the entire system in place at once. Now, if you're going to suggest it's physics, fine. Show me. You show me what physical properties will get you information. That burden's on you, not on me. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. Now, there's another way to get this. It might just be that we have true, legitimate information in the room in the form of DNA. But if that's the case, now we're looking for an author that transcends the room or outside the room for an explanation. Because the only thing that's in the room to work with is space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry. If those things won't do it, we're outside the room. Do you see the problem here, folks? And that's why we would say the best explanation is outside the room. Now, let me just say one last thing to you about this. You think about it. We ask a lot of tricky questions as detectives. You've asked the same kinds of questions when you've written papers for your high school or college essays. You know the questions I'm talking about, right? What happened? When did it happen? How did it happen? Why did it happen? Where did it happen? These are the questions we typically ask, right? At every investigation I've ever worked. But if I ask these questions and I stop right there, no one's ever going to go to jail. No one. Because the most important question hasn't been asked yet. That's the who question. You don't ask a who question, no one goes to jail. You can know everything you want to know about where it happened, when it happened, why it happened, how it happened. Until you ask who did it, no one goes to jail. Now, interestingly, scientists refuse to ask that one question. Oh, no, they'll ask all those questions. No problem. I'm thinking to myself, okay, wait a minute. Okay, I get it, but look, there's another question you're leaving out, right? You know that, right? You're leaving out the who question. Oh, no, we don't ask who questions in science. Why? We just don't. I get that you don't. My question is, why wouldn't you ask a who question if all the evidence is pointing to a who instead of a what? Why wouldn't you ask a who question? But you tell me by principle you refuse to ask who questions? Then you wonder why you get stupid answers? Because you're refusing to ask the one question that would give you the right answer. It turns out what's happening here is not a lack of information. It's a refusal to ask the right questions. This is what Goetz says about this. He says, yeah, you got to ask who questions. A necessary requirement, he says, for generating meaningful information is the ability to select from alternatives. When you write a paper, you're picking the words you want to use. You also are deselecting the words you don't want to use. You're picking from alternatives. That's what it is to write information. You're always picking from alternatives. And this requires an intelligent volitional entity. Unguided, random processes, they can't get that done. Not in any amount of time. I don't care how much time you give it, it's not going to happen. Why? Because this selection process demands continuous guidance by intelligent beings that have a purpose. That's right. If there's something outside the room that is intelligent and communicative, now you've got a proper explanation for what we're seeing inside the room. Does that make sense, folks? Again, we're back to this principle. Inside or outside the room, we talked about it before. It's all about an intruder investigation. And intruders change everything. They turn death scenes into what? Crime scenes. And if you had this sense of curiosity, we have to turn it into a sense of urgency. If there is a mind that is in charge of all of this, that has designed you and me, it's urgent that we take this weekend to make a decision. It's urgent that we tell our friends. We have to have a sense of urgency. Now, when I drew it in the book, these are the eight pieces I think that are best explained inside or outside, folks. Outside. Now, I only covered one of these. But these are all best explained, it turns out, outside the room. Now, I'm going to leave you with one last thing before we go. When I go to a crime scene, and I see junk on the floor, and I have to explain all this evidence at the crime scene, I know that in the end, this evidence is going to tell me something about my suspect before I ever meet my suspect. Did you know that? So I'm starting to develop a suspect profile in my head and then in my notes before I know what I'm looking for. Why do I know what I'm looking? I know based on the evidence. Look, if a guy gets killed at a 7-Eleven while he's working one night and the money's missing from the till, he's been shot, okay, that's one thing. If the same guy is killed in his bedroom stabbed 70 times in the groin, well, that's a little bit different kind of killer. Agreed? Which of those two killers knows my victim intimately? So in the second kind of murder, I'm looking for somebody who knows my victim intimately. The entire world of potential suspects has now been drawn down to just two or three. Which is easier to work? The one in the bedroom. You know something. You learn something about your suspect from crime scenes. The same thing happens here. There are pieces of evidence in the universe that draw a picture of what we're looking for. And it's not Mick Jagger. Because why? Because these things require a certain kind of suspect. A suspect that is non-spatial. A suspect that is immaterial. A suspect that's a designer, a fine tuner of all physics. A suspect that can create information as an intelligent source. That is the designer behind the design of biology. That is a mind that creates in its own image other beings with minds who have free agency. That is the moral objective standard for all moral truth. And is even the standard of righteousness that we use to call something evil. I'm looking for that kind of suspect, and that is not Mick Jagger. But it turns out there is one suspect before I've ever even opened a single page of Scripture. Because in that book I wrote, I didn't even talk about Scripture through any of this evidence. You can actually come to the conclusion that Yahweh exists on the basis of the evidence in the crime scene. Because he happens to have all those attributes. Every one of these attributes is described in Scripture. Now, this is a guy I arrested in 2009. For a crime he did in 1979. He was 27 when he committed the murder. We convicted him on the basis of several forms of evidence. We had some witness statements. We had some behavioral stuff that he did back in the day when he was younger. We had some material evidence at the crime scene. And we even had some statements he made to us that didn't make any sense. These were different kinds of forms of evidence. Some were eyewitnesses. Some was behavior. Some was material evidence. And some finally was just statements. And by the way, we used different experts to testify in these four different categories. And when you have four different categories of evidence, all of which point to the same suspect, you've probably got a good case. Because they are different kinds of evidence in different disciplines. Same thing happens here. We have four entirely different kinds of evidence all pointing to the same kind of causal suspect. cosmological evidence. Astrophysicists test about this stuff. They come in and they testify about it's astrophysicists, it's physicists. Here in biological evidence, it's biochemists, it's people who are in the biological sciences. Here it's people who are in the neurosciences and in philosophy, and here these are ethicists and philosophers. They all point to the same suspect. That's probably a good suspect. Now let me tell you what a guy like Robert Shapiro, who I've been up against in court before, what he would do. He would say, Jim, those 8 pieces of evidence, I can explain those other ways. I can think of, for example, 4 or 5 explanations for the first piece, 3 more for the next piece. I can think of a bunch of different ways to explain this. Not your way. I can think of ways that I could explain this. And by the way, this is what people who stay inside the room try to do. And why doesn't this work? Because this guy does not agree with this guy. This guy thinks this guy's an idiot. These guys don't agree. He doesn't agree with this guy. They're offering explanations, but they don't even agree with each other. Not only that, the explanation offered over here is found nowhere else. So what do I need? I need like 20 explanations to explain these. That's one way to do it. Or you could do it the other way. One explanation that unifies everything. So you can either offer me a bunch of things that don't even relate to each other and say that somehow explains it, or one explanation. Which is more reasonable? This is what we do in criminal trials. I'm here to tell you right now, we've been searching for years for a theory of everything that will unify all of physics, quantum physics to macro physics. I've discovered it. There is a theory of everything. It's called God. That explains everything. Make sense? This is how we work these cases. Now, I'm just going to leave you with a challenge for tomorrow. Folks, I say this in a lot of my talks. Well, I want to first invite you. Did you guys visit the book tables and the resource tables? Look, I hate selling books. I'll tell you that right now. I hate it. But the only way to deep dive into these issues is to deep dive into these issues. You know that, right? Now, what I'll do on my part is that my 2 talks, I will send you the videos for my 2 talks, including all the other 7 pieces of evidence. I'll send you the entire long video for that, okay? So you have it. I'll send you the PDF files on both talks. The MP3s for both talks. Here's how you're going to get it. If you take one picture of anything tonight, you're going to take a picture of this. This is our website, and this is the hidden page I set up this morning on the plane before I got here. Type that into your browser, coldcasechristianity.com/resources. I will send you all of that material. Make sense? And type it in, because I'll send it to you by Monday. You'll have it by Monday. So get in there by Monday, okay? Let me challenge you for tomorrow. Cops have this bad habit of dividing the entire world into 2 stark categories. There are sheep and there are wolves. And you know Scripture describes us as what? Sheep. That's not a compliment. Sheep are the one animal that are dumber than Labradors. I swear to you. The only animal dumber than a Labrador. No, I'm just saying. My point, though, is they're dirty, they're stupid. They don't even know they're being picked off by wolves. They don't. They're like having breakfast one morning. Hey, where's Charlie? Charlie was here yesterday. Where is he? It's a big blood spot on the ground. They have no idea where Charlie is. He's been picked off by a wolf. They don't even know. There's another animal in the yard, though, that his job is to protect sheep from wolves. You know that animal as a sheepdog. Sheepdogs protect sheep from wolves. I want to challenge you this weekend. If you have been kind of consuming Christianity and coming to church and being fed at a church setting, you've been sheep. That's great. I want you to now turn a corner toward sheepdog. You have to know enough of why this is true to protect good ideas from bad ideas. To protect your own kids from bad ideas. We have to be sheepdogs. Every one of us has to be a sheepdog. And I'll tell you this, if we had a yard full of sheepdogs, we would not have a wolf problem. But we have a wolf problem both inside the church and outside the church because we have too few sheepdogs. You're all being commissioned this weekend to become sheepdogs. And I mean good sheepdogs, not crummy sheepdogs, not Labradors. I'm talking about good sheepdogs. I was running with my wife the other day. We're running in the trails in Southern California, and we see a sign at the beginning of the trail. Well, I couldn't believe I saw it. I almost wanted to laugh out loud because it was a sign for a missing dog. And they posted their missing dog sign out in this wilderness area, and the dog was a Chihuahua. Okay? Oh, yeah, missing Chihuahua. That's good. Can you imagine? Now, had it been a missing Great Dane, we'd be going, don't worry about it. It'd be fine. But missing Chihuahua? That's not good. Where would you even look for a missing Chihuahua? I'll tell you where you look for a missing Chihuahua. You look in the coyote poop, okay? Because that's where you find your Chihuahua. Am I right? Okay. Now, if I'm missing a Great Dane, don't sweat it. Go to the nearest shelter. He's just waiting for you to show up. Big dogs don't have to bark, get nervous. Big dogs are confident. Big dogs retain their composure. Big dogs stay calm. Chihuahuas make a lot of noise. We are not to be Christian Chihuahuas. We have to have the confidence of the big sheepdog. But don't you waste this opportunity. You've got Lee here for the entire weekend. He'll be here on Sunday morning. If I had a chance to see, Lee's like a brother to me. I love this. You have got a great blessing just being in this church this weekend to hear from Lee. So let's make sure we don't waste this opportunity. Let's pray. Father, we know that you, in the end, will use us. No matter who we are. No matter how much we know. We don't have to know a lot for you to use us. We know that. But we'd like to be used in an even more powerful way than you're using us now. And if that's going to happen, I know that you're going to require more of us. Would you help us to stop being so darn lazy? Would you help us to take our time that we've been spending on Netflix or whatever it is we're doing with our time and give it back to you? We give you our mind. We want to worship you with more than just our words, our prayers, and our songs. We want to worship you with our minds. Help us to do that. We love you very much, Father. We pray this in the name of your precious and powerful Son, Jesus Christ. And everyone here says, amen. Amen. Thanks, guys.